and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of one of the largest and oldest wrestling families on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome the creator of the popular 605 podcast and the president of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, your co-host, the great Ryan Last.
Hello again, friends, and welcome back to another edition of Ron Fuller's Studcast. I am the great Ryan Last. It's my pleasure to be with you once again as the Tennessee Stud takes us down that road of wrestling history, up and down the Smoky Mountains, from one side of the state of Tennessee to the other, getting title matches this week. But without any further ado, the man who gets those title matches, the man of the hour, the host of the Studcast, the legendary Tennessee Stud himself, Ron Fuller. Ron, how are you?
I am great, Brian. Just fantastic, my man. And really looking forward to this one. Got a lot of info in this one for fans. And we're going to, like you said, we're going to be traveling across the state. Then we're going to take a little airplane ride, another one of those funky little airplane rides that I get involved in. And I think this one will be a very, very good one for fans. And my old horse here, he's saddled up, and we're ready to roll whenever you are, my man.
Well, you know, your first airplane ride story with Ron Wright was very, very popular here on the show. And here we are with a second one. I'm sure this one will be popular. But on the topic of popular, real quick, top of the show, thank you for everyone on Patreon, all the new patrons, everyone at tnstud.com for checking out Super Studcast 19, Part 1, the first 90 minutes with Dirty Dutch Mantel. We really do appreciate the reaction to this episode, and it was a blast to just sit back and listen to Ron and Dirty Dutch Mantel go back and forth. Check it out today. We'll have more information later in the show, but you can check it out at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. But Ron, where are we going to today here on the Studcast?
Well, we're going to get the results for the last episode of May 30th, 1975 Knoxville card. We're going to go back to Memphis for a third NWA world title match against Jack Briscoe in a 6-week period of time, pretty much unheard of. We're going to dive into the summer of 1975 with the June 6th card and the TV that supports that card. Give an update on the $100,000 lawsuit, and we're going to explain how I become close friends with one of the most famous forensic anthropologists in the world, Dr. William Bass of the University of Tennessee. And then end today's program with another one of those death-defying airplane flights with Ron and Don Wright. I get invited again to take that trip to them with them because they're on that Memphis card, and wow. This one is it may be better than the last story. So,
hey, Ron, now you have obviously as your top heel tag team, the Basses, Ron and Don Bass, managed by Sam Bass. And you said you become friends with the most famous forensic, anthropologist in the world, Dr. William Bass. No relation, obviously.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of Basses in the program now, and I have to bring another one on board, it looks like. You know, it's just odd that his name happens to be Bass, too. But we're going to talk a little bit about that, too, since I opened the door last week with talking about my personal life. We're going to dig into that just a little bit on the next few episodes and see how fans like it, see how they react to it. And so, we've got another Bass to talk about today.
All right. Well, where are we going to start with? You said we're going to talk about the show at Chilhowee Park, May 30th, 1975, correct?
That's correct. We're going to start out with the last two matches on that May 30th, 75 card. I don't think in the last episode that I gave the results of these last two matches. The semifinal event was the Assassin and me against Ron and Don Wright. And this match ends up in a disqualification of the Assassin and I, with more action outside the ring than inside, and all four of us fighting at the same time. Pretty much an out-of-control match from beginning to end, and it's going to play into the next week's match that will be a Texas Tornado match and put all four of us into the ring. The main event was scheduled to be Ron and Don Bass, managed by Sam Bass, putting up their Tennessee Tag Championships against Jimmy Golden and Jerry Jarrett. And those two guys had their hair on the line against the belts of the champions. Jerry Jarrett was not able to wrestle due to an injury received earlier in the week. And when the bell rang for this one on the 30th of May, the three Basses went to the ring first. Jimmy Golden came to the ring alone. Golden took the microphone and explained the injury of Jarrett to the audience. A pretty big crowd at Chilhowie Park. We were outside that night. The Basses were more than happy to acknowledge that Jarrett's injury came at their hands the preceding Tuesday night in Louisville, Kentucky, and the three of them then had a big laugh in the ring about his injury. Then they started focusing on Golden. When the new ring announcer and TV host, Phil Franey, gave the microphone to Sam Bass, who asked for it, he starts right out on Jimmy, and I'm standing in the back and listening to this, and he starts out and he says to Jimmy, too bad your partner isn't here tonight, because you're going to have to forfeit the match, and you're going to have your head shaved right now. Ricky Gibson, who is a friend of Jimmy's, been friends for years, and he knows what's going on. He realizes that Jimmy has no partner for this match that night because Jarrett is hurt. He's not there at all. So Gibson's prepared. He comes down to ringside with his gear on, expecting that he'll be able to take Jarrett's place. He jumps into the ring beside Golden, and he says to Jimmy that he's been willing to take care of Jarrett's take Jerry Jarrett's place and put his hair up as well as Golden for the chance to win the belts. Says it right over the PA so that everybody can hear it. Sam Bass came back to the microphone that now is held by Phil Rainey, the announcer, and Sam takes the mic away from Phil and he says, we have discussed your suggestion, but your name is not on the contract for this match, and we've decided to take the forfeit win and watch them shave Jimmy Golden's head. Well, the crowd booed like crazy. They didn't like that. Jimmy has no chance of even having a match and the possibility of winning or whatever. Sam screamed over the microphone for the crowd to shut up. Phil got the mic and he gave it to Golden. Jimmy says, okay, I agree to have my head shaved now. Oh, the crowd booed again because they didn't want to see Jimmy lose his hair, and especially not in that way. And Gibson, who was obviously concerned, he grabbed Jimmy and he drug him away, and they put their heads together to discuss further how they might be able to get him involved, get Ricky involved. The Basses huddled on the other side of the ring. Now I've heard it out from the end of the dressing room. I got to walk out there and see what this is all about. So Sam Bass comes out of the huddle first. They got two huddles on two different sides of the ring. Sam comes out of his huddle first. He takes the microphone and says, all three of us agree to give you two a shot at our titles, if and only if both of you agree not just to shave your heads, but if you lose, to also leave town too. Now the crowd erupted into a prolonged boo, man. I mean, they were like, absolutely not. You know, it's bad enough them having to put their hair up, but now they want them to leave, too, if they lose. And after a brief talk, Gibson and Golden spoke to the announcer privately off to the side. Then Phil Rainey has a microphone to himself, and he speaks to the crowd and the Basses as well over the microphone. He says Golden and Gibson agree to shave their heads and both leave town, as the Basses had suggested, if they lose. The crowd booed even louder than when Sam Bass suggested it. And then Phil got the crowd quieted, and then he continued. But, he said, Golden and Gibson agreed to this only if pointing to Sam Bass. If you, Sam Bass, agree to leave ringside and make this a fair two-on-two match, the crowd now, for the first time, roars their approval. They like that idea. The Basses back in a huddle again. They got to talk about it a little more. And this time, Ron Bass comes out of the huddle, and he goes and takes the microphone. And he says, that will not happen. He is our manager and will never leave our sides for a championship match. And if you don't take our offer for both of your heads to be shaved and both of you to leave town if you lose, then we will accept the forfeit by Golden and have the distinct pleasure of seeing him shave his head right here in this ring tonight. The crowd went wild booing again. I mean, we're back to boos again. So Golden and Gibson, they huddle again, and Gibson takes the microphone this time. And he says, okay, we accept your offer to face us both for your titles. And if we lose, we both have our heads shaved right here and leave town tonight, and Sam Bass can stay at ringside. The crowd roared its disapproval, maybe louder than ever at this point. And then Jimmy comes and takes the mic for one last time, and he says, everybody in the state of Tennessee is sick of you guys being their champions, and Ricky and I are 100% in agreement. We want more than ever to beat your Bass asses and finish your reign as champions right here tonight, and it doesn't matter to us what the consequences are. You guys are going down tonight. Crowd roared. The match was made. Phil Rainey explained it to everybody. What had been agreed upon, and he left the ring, and the bell was rung. Sam Bass stayed at ringside, and he's going to have a great impact on the finish of this match, and what a great match it was.
So, Ron, what really went down with Jerry Jarrett? Because obviously, he would never come back. I mean, this was the end of Jerry Jarrett coming to shows in Knoxville for you. What really happened there? What led to Ricky Gibson having to fill in?
Well, there's some things going on. Some of them I probably won't get to explain this week, but Jared and I are about to end our relationship. And it's based around some of the things we talked about in my personal life last week. The fact that my wife was going back to college and that she was going to be in an archaeological dig for the entire summer and have my kids with her staying on the road. And I didn't like that concept. So there's a lot more going on here to the fact than the fact that Jarrett's not at this particular match. And it's probably a lot of it has to do with the fact that I want to try to save my marriage and save my family at this point. And I'm willing to go and do the dig in Manchester, Tennessee, as well as my wife. And when I tell Jerry that, he's not too happy with that fact. I'm the Southern Heavyweight Champion. I'm basically saying I can't work Mondays in Memphis for you anymore. And, he and I had this discussion a couple of days before this match. And that's why he decides that he's not going to come back anymore. So we're about to have a parting of the ways. I'm going to be strictly using all my own talent for the remainder of the summer. And I'm pulling out of Memphis shots, and I'm also losing that Memphis income, which was very important to me at this point.
Well, I got to say, though, and like you said, we'll get to more of that next week on the show. You weren't planning on talking about it this week. But if it's 1975, I'll take that trade any day. Ricky Gibson for Jerry Jarrett. Ricky Gibson, how good was Ricky Gibson in 1975?
Ricky Gibson was a fantastic worker in 1975, his entire career, basically. I think he's a better worker than his brother Robert of Rock and Roll Express, and so did a lot of other promoters and owners around the country. Ricky is on the top of his game, and yeah, that trade, basically Ricky Gibson for Jerry Jarrett, is a hell of a trade on my behalf. You know, I mean, it really benefits me a lot more than it does Jarrett, and losing me over there is going to be a problem for Jarrett too, because I've been drawing some pretty fantastic houses there, and it's going to affect his business as well. So it's a bad deal for me in a way. I'm going to lose a tremendous amount of income. I've picked up another good star to replace a guy like Jarrett, But it's going to affect mine and Jerry's relationship some in an adverse way, and I'm not too happy about that. We were doing very well by trading some talent. It seemed to help us both, and now that potential is gone.
Ron, you were a booker and you were a promoter. Where does "I have to leave, I'm going on an archaeological dig" rank amongst the reasons someone gave for giving notice?
I would say it's probably the most unusual way to ask somebody if you can not work their town for them anymore and then you're not available. I mean, I'm sure, you know, I think I talked to him about it over the phone. I could not see his face, but I heard a long pause at the end of it. He was trying to think. He was trying to figure out just exactly what you're saying. Did he really say he's going to go dig up relics out of the ground rather than wrestle for the summer? You know, it's like, so, you know, it was very strange, you know, and I don't think Jerry ever really got over it. You know, that I kind of left him. I think he felt like I left him in the lurch. But once we had this discussion, it wasn't long until I was gone from Memphis. Didn't have many shows left there after that point. And obviously, he never came back to Knoxville for any shows after that.
And not too long after that, Robert was gone from Memphis, too.
That's right. Same thing, you know. And I don't know that that didn't have some effect on Rob and his leaving there as well. So, you know, it was a bad thing, but I was doing it for a very personal reason. I really, really wanted to save my marriage and I wanted to spend my life with my sons. And, you know, I did my best here. I really sacrificed myself and my company in the summer of 75 for that purpose.
I do wish you had a chance, though, to be like in Gimmick, the Tennessee Stud, like is Indiana Jones, you know, like this archaeologist.
That would have been something.
It would have been good. It would have been good.
Shots of that, man. You know, I should have had my cowboy hat and gears on when I was working in those trenches there, digging those things, and have some pictures taken, you know, to prove this is where I am, you know, so.
Well, I'll tell you what, Ron, you know, you mentioned that Sam Bass would play a part in the finish of this match, but we didn't actually discuss the finish of this match. What happened in this big match?
Well, this match, basically, this tag match had no wrestling in it. It was a war from beginning to the end. I mean, during the course of probably a 30-minute match, Sam Bass kept passing his boys a foreign object that they used to open up both Golden and Gibson's head. They had the two baby faces bleeding pretty badly. The Bass boys tried for a cover again and again, but to end it, but it just couldn't quite finish the bleeding young baby faces off. The crowd kept those boys in it with the roar after roar each time they kicked out. So finally, the baby faces both made a huge comeback, and the amphitheater was going wild when Golden had Don Bass down in one corner, and the referee was trying to pull him off. In the other corner, Gibson had Ron Bass pinned in the corner and was up on the ropes, pounding old Big Ron when Sam got up on the apron and nailed Gibson in the side of the head with the same object that they had been using the entire match. Gibson went down backwards, straight off, probably standing on the second rope, and took a pretty nasty bump, and Ron Bass was about to cover him when Sam motions Ron to pick him up, you know, and full Nelson him and bring him over here so that I can knock him out, really knock him out. And that's what Big Ron does. So when he brings him over there so Sam can deliver the coup de grace, basically, the referee's back is still turned. He's still trying to separate Golden and Don Bass. And Bass has got Gibson in that full Nelson. And when he shoves him over there to where Bass is, Bass throws a wild ass punch and Gibson ducks it. Ron Bass got knocked out. I mean, he went down. I don't think he got up for a couple of minutes. And Gibson fell back on top of him. At the same time, the referee finally got Golden off for Don Bass and saw the pin. So Sam Bass on the outside on the apron, he starts to come into the ring. and Jimmy Golden hits him with the most beautiful drop kick. It actually put Sam Bass into the second row of ringside. I mean, he just flew back out the ropes and into the ringside seats. 1, 2, 3, the old ref counted us out, and another great match in Knoxville history was in the books. Two very young fighting baby faces had conquered one of the best heel teams in the world. So it was very exciting for the fans. They really, really loved it. Golden and Gibson really loved it, obviously, as well. I don't think that they probably spent 10 minutes after the Basses got in the dressing room out there with the crowd celebrating. It was really a great night for wrestling there in Knoxville.
It's a great way to instantly establish a young babyface tag team, because they had no experience, no history together until this night. And right away, you have Jimmy Golden, who was already over, and now Ricky Gibson with him there, and instant tag team. Boom.
Yeah, instant, and not only just a tag team, but a top tag team. I mean, those boys are really, really talented, and they're both young and driving baby faces. They've got that heart, and they just won't quit, especially Ricky. Ricky was a fighter in the ring. He just would not get beat. So it was a fantastic match, and like you say, it was a great way to get those guys off the ground quick as the top babyface team. So let's go back to Memphis for a little bit if we can, okay? So on the first Monday in June of 1975, I go back to Memphis for a third NWA world title match in 6 weeks with Jack Briscoe in one town. That's pretty much unheard of. I'm now a babyface there after saving my brother and father in that continuing battle they were having with the three Australians, George Barnes, Bill Dundee, and Johnny Gray. And that had turned into a war between them. And all three of these world title matches occurred after I had turned babyface. I went and helped my brother and my dad out. Automatically, man, I became a huge babyface in Memphis. And about that time, Jack Briscoe arrived. So that made them, these three matches that I have with Briscoe, more difficult, because Briscoe's a very unusual babyface world champion. I can't think of hardly any babyface world champions, to be honest with you. And I think Jack is as close to one as there ever was. And he was forced to heel some in all three of those matches, which he was not accustomed to, because I was more over as a babyface than he was. After I'd helped my dad and my brother, heck, I was the biggest babyface in Memphis at that point. And, you know, bigger than the world champion even. So still, in my opinion, these were not nearly as good a world title matches as any of the others I had ever been in or would be in, because there was no clear-cut heel. I mean, it's really difficult to work it. It certainly did not affect the attendance, though. The April 14th World Championship match was an 11,300-person sellout. The April 28th, 75 World Championship match 2 weeks later was another sellout of 11,300. And this last one on June 2nd, 1975, is going to do over 9,000 and 9,118 fans. These three NWA World title matches brought almost 32,000 fans into the Mid-South Coliseum. I doubt that any three world title matches in the history of Memphis wrestling ever exceeded that figure, especially considering they took place in just a six-week period of time. That's unbelievable to wrestle the same champion three times in 6 weeks and be able to draw those type of crowds. All three cards were also loaded with Welches. My father and my brother worked tag partners on that first world title shot I had with Briscoe. My brother and Jimmy Golden worked tag partners on the second shot I have with Briscoe, and my brother and Jimmy both worked single matches on the third one. So, you know, the Welches are very much represented in these huge crowds that they're experiencing, far beyond anything I think they had ever seen at that point in 1975. And let's talk a little bit, if we can, Brian, about those three matches. The first was a 60-minute time limit draw. The second was a win for me by disqualification. And the third was the only one that I actually lost. The first one, the 60-minute time limit draw, or Broadway, as me and Jack Briscoe he used to call them back in the early days of 1970 when Louis Tillett was booking in Florida. That one was the most difficult, the 60-minute one, obviously. Back in those early days of Florida, for me, it seemed that either Jack or I would always get at least one 60-minute time limit draw per week, and it seemed like each of us got at least one. And I don't know why Louis did so many of them, maybe because he had a hard time as a booker coming up with a finish. Pretty hard to come up with a finish for a world championship match. I can only thank the good Lord that those early Broadways in my career were not ever against Briscoe. God, this one I have with Jack is enough for me. Jack had to be the most in shape and hardest worker of any of the at least 10 NWA world champions that I wrestled in my career. He was in phenomenal shape and just never stopped. It was amazing to have to work with him. And it was absolutely, it was horrifying at times because he just never blew up. So wrestling against matches, wrestling the matches against other babyfaces are the most difficult matches for me. And I think it was for all wrestlers, barely actually wrestling and doing lots of it in a match. That was necessary in these type of matches that we had in Memphis. It's extremely tiring. The last 5 minutes especially seem like an eternity. With all the high spots, difficult bumps, and false finishes that are important at the end of those 60-minute time limit matches, the last 5 minutes are critical to whether the match is a great one or it's not going to be. And sadly, this third match in 6 weeks was the last time I would ever work against Jack Briscoe or see him even before his death on February 1st in 2010. I give Jack Briscoe credit for his phenomenal amateur career, being a fantastic role model for me in my career, and for, in my opinion, being the most legitimate NWA heavyweight world champion of all time. I can tell you the news of his untimely death in 2010 brought tears to my eyes, and it affected me more than the loss of any world champion that I ever knew.
Hey, Ron, if I could ask you a couple questions real quick on the topic of Jack Briscoe. You wrestled him early on in your career in Florida, like you said. You wrestled him here when he was a world champion. Do you have a match that, obviously it may not exist on video, but exists in your head, the best match you ever had with him? When was it and where was it?
I think the best match I ever had with him was in Knoxville for the world championship in the same year of 75. And I actually won that match. I actually got my hand raised, got the belt given to me, went to the dressing room with the belt. I felt like that I was the world champion. I think if things had been different back in 75, the territories weren't doing these swaps of the belt the first night in, and then the guy wins them back the last night before they leave. The type of thing they started doing later on, they weren't doing back in those days. You didn't see those little one-week title swaps. And I think that would have been 10 years later, I would have loved to have done one of those 10 one-week title swaps like that with any world champion. Would have been great for my territory. But that one, to me, was the best match I had with Jack Briscoe. And the fact that I actually won and left the ring with the belt just made it kind of special for me. That doesn't happen very often, that you get out of the ring with a belt.
On that topic, because that's an interesting thing you just said, that you could see yourself 10 years later doing one of these swaps. And of course, Dusty got a few of them. Giant Baba paid a lot of money. I don't even think it went to the NWA. I think it went right to Harley Race and made that deal. Tommy Rich, notoriously. Kerry Von Erich, even a little bit later towards the end of the NWA, is really being a group of promoters working together in 1984. There were various guys. You could see yourself doing that. Do you think, first of all, who would you have done it for? Would it have been like, hey, can we get a week Jerry Stubbs, the NWA world champion? Or would you have done it for yourself? And secondly, is it harder to book someone after that, after they have a title reign between 2 days and 8 days?
That's a good question.
And they don't have to chase for the title anymore. Is it harder to book them after that short title run that it may not even make it all worth it?
I don't know. Now, let's go back to the first part of this question that you asked me. I don't know that I would have done it with me. I believe I would have done it with Bob Armstrong.
Interesting.
Rather than myself, simply because people would have looked at me and gone, well, he's the owner, you know, and it would have not been a good deal for me to have done that. But Bob Armstrong would have been a great candidate for that and deserved it. If some of these other guys got that 1 week run, Bob Armstrong is more deserving than any of those guys that I can think of, to be honest with you. He would have been phenomenal for that. And the last part of that question was what again you were going to about.
How do you book him after that? Okay, so Bob Armstrong gets a 1 week title run, let's say, and now the fans have seen him chase for the title. They've seen him get the title, and he's still going to be in your territory. Is it so hard to book him after that that it almost makes the title run ineffective?
Well, I would tell you, and you know, I've never given this any thought, but if I had worked a deal like that where Bob had won the belt, and lots of times I was the heel and Bob was the babyface for many, many years, that would have worked out fabulous for me. I would have, when he dropped it, I would have been involved in having him drop it. And that would have gone right back to making me and Bob a top hot match that would have drawn money. I could have utilized it to help my business in the future. I wouldn't have just traded the belt back and had Flair beat him as an example. And then Bob, you know, just not be champion anymore. It would have worked out perfectly because I worked all these programs in which Flair at times had bounties on me. And sometimes I collected bounties from Flair because he put them on somebody else. So, you know, we had that history. Bob and I had that history. Would have been a tremendous angle to been responsible for Flair getting the title back from Bob.
Interesting. Interesting little discussion there, but I know we're running late on time. Let's get back to this. Did you have any more to say about Jack Briscoe here?
No, I have one more dramatic event associated with this, with the third World Championship on June 2nd. And this is the by far the most memorable thing that happened that day. And it doesn't have anything to do with wrestling. It has to do with the flight to Memphis on that day. And as you might imagine, this flight is not on a jet, but once again on Ron Wright's plane. And I'm going to save that for the end of the show today. I really love this story. It is pretty unbelievable, but people that know the Wrights, especially Ron Wright, would believe it because it actually happened. And so, you know, I'd say, you know, we'll get to that later in the show.
Well, Ron, we will get back to the story in just a moment, but first, this word about Super Studcast number 19, part 1, 90 minutes with Dirty Dutch Mantel.
No two Super Studcasts are even similar. The Stud interacts with every guest in a unique manner. Super Studcast number 19 with Down and Dirty Dutch Mantel is no exception. At tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. This one has a feel of familiarity, friendship, and just plain fun. Interesting subjects, stories, and sometimes tragedy. Like the death of Bruiser Brody, who is a very good friend of both Dutch and Ron, and it becomes the highlight of the show. You never know what to expect, and that fact makes all Super Studcasts a must for fans around the world. If you've been wondering why these Super Studcasts are so popular, you owe it to yourself to find out just how educational and satisfying 3 hours of wrestling history can be. Become a patron today at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast for only $2.99. Saddle up for part 2 on Tuesday, July 30th for the once a month ride of your life.
There you hear it. Super Studcast number 19, part 1, the Down and Dirty edition with Dirty Dutch Mantel. Hear all about the hijinks and all the funny stories that the Dirty Dutchman has to share with Ron. Stuff that they've never talked about. They've never talked about the unfortunate murder of Bruiser Brody. They've never talked about some of the riots they've been in. There are so many different topics. It's more than just a interview. It's a conversation with two wrestling legends. Check it out today at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast for only $2.99. You get in the door. It's the best deal in wrestling. Check it out today. And we'll have more information about it later on in the show. But Ron, it sounds like we're going to save that Ron Wright plane story for the main event. Let's get back to some of the other things you mentioned at the top of the show you were going to talk about. The summer of 1975, as well as, I guess, this $100,000 lawsuit is still hanging over your head.
Yes, it definitely is. And let's just jump right back into it. Let's dive into that southeastern summer of 1975, starting with June 6th in Knoxville's Chilhowee Park. The opening match was George McCreary against Rocky Smith, the former Inferno. Very good match, obviously, and the veteran Smith leads young McCreary and ends in a time limit draw, 20 minutes. Second match, Mongolian Stomper versus Dennis Condrey. Much better competition for Stomper than the previous 2 weeks, where he beat two opponents each night. Condrey was up and coming talent, really going to go places in his future. And he gives Stomper a really good match that night, but not quite good enough that Stomper wins again. Due to the result of the week before, where all four men were in the ring in the amphitheater and out of control most of the match, the third match that night was the Texas Tornado match with the Assassin, Jody Hamilton, and myself against Ron and Don Wright. This one's wild, as you would expect, and all four men in the ring at the same time. The Assassin and I won this match in preparation for the following week because we're going to wrestle the new tag champions. And speaking of the new tag champions, Jimmy Golden and Ricky Gibson defended their Tennessee tag titles on June the 6th. Against the former champions Ron and Don Bass, with Sam Bass managing, in a 2-out-of-3 fall match, and the young champions won a hard-fought match in the middle of the ring in 2 straight falls. Really get those guys over. The Southeastern TV show on WBIR the following day on May 31st, 75, is going to promote this night that we talked about, this gave the results for. And on that TV program, it's centered around the first match with the new tag team champions Golden and Gibson getting a strong win, with Jimmy throwing a beautiful drop kick off the top rope in this match. The new champions, with a roar of applause, then go from the studio audience, they go directly to the set with Les Thatcher, and they show this long involved introduction that I just talked about for that title match with the Basses. And then they show the video of the great victory. And there they sit side by side, describing this win with both of their foreheads taped up. And that pretty much completed the story about what happened in that match. Basses made a great interview after the commercial break, and the TV show was off to a great start. The second match was another victory for the unexpectedly over Mongolian Stomper. He is really getting there. After his win, he caused the normal panic around the studio when it appears he's ready to attack the crowd. And Dennis Condrey goes and makes a rare interview after the commercial break to promote his upcoming match the next Friday. Okay, and so this fit in perfectly with the next segment, the personality profile, and it happens to be of the Mongolian Stomper and his manager, Bearcat Wright. Les Thatcher dug into the fantastic background of the Stomper as Bearcat answered his probing questions, and then the Stomper stood in the background, constantly flexing his muscles by bending this steel truck spring that he used to carry with him on every show. He would bend it and then let it straighten and bend it and let it straighten again and again. He did that for the entire 5-minute segment. Fans at home, I thought, must have been amazed, maybe as much as my director, Bill Kincaid, who was sitting with me in the control room, and he just kept asking me during the personality profile about Stomper, and he kept going, "How can he do that? How can he do that for 5 minutes?" The regular person couldn't have bent that truck spring one single time, and he was just constantly bending it. Third TV match was a win for Dennis Condrey, who's going to be facing the Stomper the following Friday. And then Ron and Don Wright joined Les at the set after the commercial break to talk about the upcoming Texas Tornado match with the Assassin and I. We've already given the results of that. And then they bragged about how good they were at fights when they were kids, in which both of them would back each other up when they were facing at least 4 or more guys at a time. And then they promised the traditional Tennessee dog whooping next Friday to the delight of the crowd. Final segment, Assassin and I together as a team on TV for the first time. We quickly dispatched two job boys. I win the match with the Fuller leg lock. We went straight to the desk while we were hot and sweating to do the next interview segment after the commercial break. From my experience, I like to have guys go to the set for interviews after their TV matches as often as possible because I thought guys make a better interview when they're all warmed up. And, in the heat of battle, coming out of that and going in and doing the interview, it just seems to lead up to a better interview. We made fun of the Hillbilly Wright brothers and the redneck crowd in the studio audience. And all in all, it was a very good ending to only the third Southeastern wrestling show that we had ever done.
And what's going on with the $100,000 lawsuit, which, a reminder to the audience, was due to a $1,000 challenge with the Professor Dale Lewis and a fan out of the crowd that got out of hand when Danny Hodge came to ringside and encouraged Professor Dale Lewis to hurt the fan a little more than I guess he expected.
Yes, a little more than he should have, to be honest with you. So by this point, I had a few connections in Knoxville, and I'd gotten some references for attorneys in the area. And I picked me one that was a wrestling fan in hopes that he'd be sympathetic to my cause. He was very frank about things and wanted to see the hold harmless agreement that was drawn up by another attorney 6 months earlier before we had the first one of these challenge matches. He made me very aware that this agreement was not going to protect me much in court if it went that far. He filed the proper paperwork to avoid a judgment if I didn't respond to the lawsuit. He recommended that I try to reach the guy that had been injured to feel him out about his anger over what had happened. Maybe pursue some type of settlement. He said he was going to do some research and see the implications and judgments in this type of case. He asked if Hodge or Lewis would be willing to foot some of this potentially expensive bill. I thought that was a lawyer type of question, made sense, but it didn't make sense for me as an owner of a wrestling company. I had no interest in finding them and asking that question. I felt responsible for what had happened because the $1,000 challenge match with fans from the crowd was totally my idea. I certainly couldn't blame Lewis because Hodge had made him do what he did. I couldn't go after Hodge because he was a good family friend to my grandfather, Roy, and my father, and I also liked Danny as well. And since I was a young owner, just starting, I was probably going to want to book Danny many times in the future. I did not want to make an enemy out of Danny. I had also started to relax some about this lawsuit because things were moving slowly on it. But I had to admit, it crossed my mind at least a couple of times every single day, undoubtedly. I just couldn't get away from it.
Well, I know we will return to this topic again on a future Studcast, Ron, but another name you brought up at the top of the show was Dr. Bass, the archaeologist, or the anthropologist, I think it may have been. Talk a little bit about Dr. Bass.
Okay. I talked last week a little bit about my personal life and my wife returning to college to get her degree. I want to briefly introduce a very important professor at the University of Tennessee that becomes a personal friend of mine through my wife having been in one of his classes. I go to pick her up one day on the campus, and I end up at her class. I actually find her classroom on that huge Tennessee campus, and the professor that ran the class is there alone talking with her, and he recognizes me instantly from the TV show. She hasn't told him that I'm a wrestler, but when I walk in the door to go and get her, he knows who I am. And it turns out he's a huge fan, and that fact alone blew me away. I mean, it was like the last place and the last person you would expect to find to be a big wrestling fan, a professor at the University of Tennessee. So let me properly introduce Dr. William Bass, born on August 30th, 1928, in Stanton, Virginia. He is a world-famous forensic anthropologist that assisted federal, local, and authorities worldwide with the identification of human remains. He used physical anthropology to resolve medical and criminal matters about the dead. He was in actuality a real-life crime scene investigator all over the world long before those CSI programs ever made it to TV. And if they had a problem figuring out who a body was anywhere in the world, he was the man for the job. They called him and from everywhere. And in his studies, he had founded a very famous 2-acre plot at a University of Tennessee site called the Body Farm, where human remains were left to decay in various natural and controlled elements. He was kind enough to take me to this body farm and show it to me. I wanted to see it. And he said, I'll take you over there, Ron. And all in all, this guy was a fascinating individual. And he's going to become great friends, he and I. And he's going to have a great influence on me, this guy. Dr. Bass had an extremely pleasant personality and hundreds of questions about wrestling. And I had just as many questions about his profession. It was through this professor that my wife had been assigned the archaeological dig in the summer of 1975 in Central Tennessee for extra credit that would help her graduate that summer. And I would be, as everybody knows at this point, working on that dig as well. We'll be talking some about this dig in the next few episodes. I'm aware that it's not totally wrestling related, but, you know, my life was not totally wrestling related. And I think a little bit of this might be very interesting to fans. Dr. Bass was a great sounding board for me with his interesting and unique perception of my Knoxville Wrestling TV show, and I took every opportunity to gain wisdom and insight from such a worldly man. And I'll talk more about this subject next week. And I wanted right now, when we're getting close on time, Brian.
We are, but I got one question for you, Ron. When you pick up your wife at school, what are you driving? 1975. The Tennessee Stud. What are you wearing and what are you driving? Are you all decked out like the Tennessee Stud when you go to a big public place like a school?
No, I'm not dressed like the Stud would be dressed. You know, I'm kind of incognito in a way, but I am driving a Cadillac. And, you know, as this the discussion between me and my wife and what's going wrong in our lives, I remember asking her one time when we were really having problems, and I said, what is it that bothers you most about your life with me? And she said, swimming pools and Cadillacs.
Wow.
And I was like, well, I don't see that. Well, that to me was like, well, that was the last thing I expected to hear out of her mouth. You know, I mean, who doesn't like swimming pools and Cadillacs, you know? So I had a hard time piecing that together. But, you know, that just, it kind of almost fell on the ground when she said that. I was like, oh, are you kidding me?
Well, I'll tell you what, Ron. Again, we'll get back to all this on a future episode, but let's not talk Cadillacs. Let's talk plane rides. And there's another plane ride apparently in store for us.
Yes, sir. It certainly is. You know, and like I said, on this third world title match in Memphis on June the 2nd, 75, it's especially memorable for me for one thing and one thing only. And that was that flight with my favorite pilot and his brother, Ron and Don Wright. You know, I'd been invited to fly across the state with the Wrights again because they were on the card that night. And obviously, I was a bit hesitant after my first flight with them to Memphis on May the 5th in 75 when we were forced to land in Florence, Alabama due to weather. And he flies through the hole in the clouds to get us back to Memphis. So, you know, and I told that story recently on the Studcast, and this time it's not going to be weather that's the problem, but Ron Wright's unscheduled landing on my father's ranch in Bolivar, Tennessee. And before I tell the story, Brian, I want to remind fans that Super Studcast number 2, and you can find that at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast, it's all about crazy Ron Wright and filled with stories about his plane. So if you want 3 hours of this type of classic entertainment, there's no better place to find it than in Super Studcast number 2. But here we go. You know, my father's a pilot at this time frame, and he has a big ranch. And on his ranch, he has his own plane, a single-engine Cessna. He's got a short landing strip, And so he could fly in and out whenever he wanted to, right from his own home. He'd just drive 300 yards from his house as his airport. And as we flew across the state, we took the northern route this time rather than the southern route that we were forced to take the last time due to weather. On this particular day, it's beautiful across the state of Tennessee. There's no problem with weather like last time. So as we approach Memphis, we're about 100 miles out. Ron Wright starts asking me about my father's plane and runway on his ranch. I had no idea that he wanted to find the ranch and try to land there to visit my dad. You know, finding it's one thing, but landing there, that becomes a whole different ballgame. You know, and the ranch is located in Bolivar, Tennessee. And when we were close to that area, or where I thought we were fairly close, Ron Wright dropped way down in altitude. We're up there around 12,000 feet, 10,000, 12,000 feet. We dropped down there to 500 feet off the ground, and we start looking for water towers. You know, you can't. You have a perspective from the air that you don't get when you're in a car on the ground, and I couldn't tell where Bolivar was from the air. So he drops down, and we start checking water towers on the city that we're making our way toward Memphis. He asked me the question if he could land on my dad's runway. You know, I was thinking, gosh, I don't think so, you know. And I told him, I said, you know, he's got a single engine plane and you've got a twin engine plane, Ron. I don't see how that's possible. So he doesn't continue. He doesn't hesitate, though. He continues to search for the water towers. We find the Bolivar Water Tower. And then we circle around, just extended circles around that water tower until I spot the farm. After about 20 minutes of searching, there it is. And once we get to the farm, the first thing they want to do is buzz the runway. My dad's got a lot of cattle, and he puts a fence, a wire fence, around his runway because the last thing you want to do is hit a cow at 100 miles an hour when you're trying to stop your plane from landing or hit one going out. You know, I mean, you're going to kill yourself that way, and that's not a good way to go. So he puts this fence around his entire runway. And, you know, the Wright boys get excited, man, as we're buzzing that short runway, man, and they start questioning each other about the possibility of landing the plane. Now, man, that totally changes the game for me. You know, I don't mind finding the place and let you look at the runway and let you look at the farm from up in the air. But when you're talking about trying to land on this little short runway, I'm really not happy about this. So I let them both know how I felt about it. But I was only a passenger, and the darn Wright boys were crazy. That's all I can say. They were just nuts. So my father's house is not too far from that runway, and he heard the plane, and he drove down to the runway. We're flying around there to make another pass, and they see him coming. And, you know, they'd not decided about landing until they saw him coming to meet us. And cows are running all around the fences there, around the runway in all directions, because he just keeps buzzing. He buzzes a second time. And when he buzzes a second time, you know, they finally decide that, yeah, we're going to try it. So there was no doubt in my mind that the answer to that question about trying to make a landing, I said, no, guys, let's go on to Memphis. I said it several times, but they didn't listen. It was a serious situation. They were just having fun with me, I thought. I thought they were ribbing me, you know. Let's just scare him that we're going to try to land. Until they decided that they could do it. And the third pass, we're lined up to land. And now things are getting real serious. And then I remember Ron Wright turns to his brother on that third pass, and he goes, let's put her down, Donnie. And I was like, oh, Ron, no way, you know. So so I said, no, let's take our butts to Memphis and put her down. I don't want to try this landing. So they both laughed, and then here we come. We're making that final approach. I never really realized how short the runway was until I see it as we're approaching. I mean, that runway used to look longer to me. It's looking shorter every time the closer we get to it. And all I could think about was that big old safe jet that I'd been flying every Monday on to Memphis, and how I wished I was on that damn jet right then, man. I just was like, it seemed like, and when we got there, it seemed like we just cleared the top of that wire fence by inches. And had we been 6 inches lower and the wheels of that plane caught the top of that fence, that's it. We're done. I mean, that plane crashes face first, and we're all dead. As the wheels touch down on the runway, after he comes right over the top of the fence, he drops it as fast as he can. And as the wheels touch on the runway, we only had, probably about a quarter of a mile to stop a twin-engine plane on a runway made for a single-engine plane. Ron started applying the brakes instantly, and the wheels, just as soon as they touched down, he just slammed on the brakes, and he never let up until we screeched to a sliding and a hopping stop. It wasn't just a sliding stop. Right when he got very close to the fence, at the end of the fence at the far end of the runway, he turned the plane sideways so that the wheels bounced off the runway, the tarmac, bang, bang, three or four bounces, and the plane finally stops. And one wing is less than 3 feet away from the fence. That's like, gosh almighty, man. So I was a little pissed at this point, to be honest with you. I dropped the door on the plane, which was in the back two seats where I was sitting. I just unscrewed the little deal, dropped the door of the plane. I grabbed my wrestling bag, and I got off cursing them two boys that brought me there. And I heard Ron say to his brother Don, as I'm getting off the plane, he goes, "Damn, Donnie," he goes, "how are we going to get her out of here?" I didn't care about that. I didn't care about it at all. Man, my dad didn't know it, but he was going to take me into Memphis that night. There was no way I was going to get back on that plane for them to try to get it off that runway. So the four of us go up to my dad's house. We have some coffee. We talk a little bit, and we go back down for those boys to take off. I saw no way there was enough runway to get safely off the ground in that shorter distance. I got on the plane and immediately started to discuss the predicament they were in. They got on the plane. As they were getting on there, they're talking about it. And Ron asked my dad and I to turn the plane around from where it had ended up sideways on the landing on the surface of the runway to face the far end of the runway so that he could get a real good shot at getting her off the ground. Ron started the plane. He started screaming above the roar of the engines. He says, "Back up the plane till it touches the fence behind it." You know, so he then opened his small little cockpit window to bark further instructions to us. We shoved the plane back to where the tail of it was within 6 inches of the fence to give them absolutely as much room as they could get and as much distance as they could get it off the ground. And then he, through that little cockpit window, he screams, he goes, "One of you guys go to the other wing and each of you hook your arms around the elbow with your elbow around the ring and hold on tight so I can give her the gas and hold down the brakes until we get the power and max at max level. Then when I say so, boys, let her go and good luck to us." I like the last line, "good luck to us." I was so glad not to be on there. So he shoved the throttle, man, wide open. And we had one arm hooked around the wing on each side. We're on each side of the plane, just holding as hard as we could. He had the brakes slammed down as hard as he could, the power all the way. We're holding on to the wings. And then at the last second, he screamed out a little cockpit window. He said, "Let her go." So we let her go. And that plane shot off down that runway like it jet catapulted off of an aircraft carrier, man. It slowly rose as it came nearer the fence at the end of the runway, and it cleared the top of it by no more than 6 inches. And, you know, when I think about it to this day, if I had put my 250-pound-plus 250 plus pounds in my bag on that plane, there is absolutely no way the three of us would have made it out of there alive. I swore to myself right then it was going to be a very long time, if not the last time, before I took another flight with Ron Wright in my life.
Well, we will see what happens in the weeks ahead here on the Studcast. But Ron, that is a perfect place to wrap up this week's episode. Want to remind everyone on Facebook, the page, Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. Like that page and get Tennessee Stud news, Studcast news, and much, much more. All you got to do is like that page and instantly you're friends with the Tennessee Stud. You can also follow the Stud on Instagram and Twitter at Ron Fuller Welch. You can follow me on Twitter at Great Brian Last. You can follow the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network on Twitter at Super Podcasts. And you can hear me on the 605 Super Podcast at 605pod.com or available wherever it is that you find your favorite podcasts for classic wrestling talk and wrestling humor. The 605 Super Podcast. Don't forget Super Studcast number 19, a down and dirty edition with Dirty Dutch Mantel, is setting all sorts of records. Listen to it today. Part 2, the highly anticipated Part 2, the rest of the story with Dirty Dutch Mantel, will be released on July 30th. Listen to Part 1 today. It is maybe the most fun Studcast, but also one that goes really, really deep and talks about some interesting things that everyone should listen to. Listen to it today. Super Studcast 19 at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Ron, where are we going next week?
Well, we're going to continue looking at Knoxville Cards and the talent from June of 1975. We're going to give a notice to Jarrett. We talked a little bit briefly about that today, that I'll be working with my wife on an archaeological dig and unavailable for the summer. That's going to cost me my Memphis income and my Southern championship as well. You know, he doesn't need a champion. It's not going to work for him. And we're going to start developing an idea for a solution to this $100,000 lawsuit and begin to experience some growth from the new television station's effort and the new talent that has arrived in 75.
Ron Fuller's Studcast is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. For the Tennessee Stud Ron Fuller, I'm the Great Brian Last. The story continues next week.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So full Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud. This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.